Well, now sitting with His Honour, Judge Graham Cliff, but with special dispensation to call him Graham this evening. Graham, you were actually at King James's Grammar School from 1959 to 1966. What are your recollections of your first day there?
Oh, of the first day, being very nervous. In those days, there were no preliminary visits to the school. My first sight of King James's was when I got to the bottom of St Helen's Gate on that morning in early September 1959. I subsequently had 7 very happy years at school. I left in 1966 when I went to Manchester University to study law. In retrospect, I think I have to confess to not being the most assiduous student ever to grace the portals of King James's. And that was because my interests and my energy were directed very much towards sporting activities when I was at school. I finished up in my final year as captain of football. That was all important. I was also vice captain of cricket and I enjoyed it all enormously. At least in the sixth form, I did enough work to acquire sufficient A levels to move on to university and subsequently to a career in the law, which I've always found very stimulating. I know that I owe that to people like Harry Taylor, who was the headmaster, Fred Hudson, who was the deputy headmaster. Both of them ran a very successful school in my view, and both of them actually taught me in the sixth form. And of course I'm indebted also to people such as Francis Barham, who taught me history, Jim Toomey, who taught me Latin, and Peter Haywood, French. And I think it's people like that that really gave me my first inkling of what true scholarship really involves. So really the debt that I owe to the school is immeasurable. I hope that together with the Old Ombudsman Society I have gone some way in recent years towards repaying that debt by helping the school to take control of the school trust fund in 2001 after it had been neglected for very many years by Huddersfield Council and Kirklees Council.
I'm interested that you should start by talking about sport, by the way, because we're sitting in your study here at the top of Arkenley Lane in Aldenbury Common, and I reckon that you're so near the cricket pitch that a good batsman would probably hit a six into your garden.
It's quite possible, and you'll see above the fireplace there is the painting of the field and the pavilion that was completed by Tony Haig. He too is an Old Ombudsman, and a couple of years ago he was commissioned by a Dr. Davis at Huddersfield University to help in producing paintings of all the cricket grounds in Kirklees. This was part of a heritage project run by the university in which they researched the history of cricket in this area, and that history is very extensive. Subsequently, the paintings that Tony Haig produced were offered back to the clubs, and in our case that picture was auctioned at our annual dinner 2 years ago. It is an original, and I decided I was going to have it, really, because I think some of the happiest hours of my life have been spent on that cricket field. And what happened was the university took half the money raised and the cricket club got the other half, so they both did quite well out of me that night. But I'm very fond of that place, and that's why it's above the mantelpiece.
As I mentioned earlier, for many years you've been a senior judge. How did your interest in the law develop?
Well, that all started, I think, when I was quite a young lad. I used to watch the usual sort of television programmes in the 1950s. I don't know if you remember one called Boyd QC.
Indeed.
And it seemed to me that that was a very glamorous way of spending a working life, you know, dressing up in fancy gear, going into court and demolishing the opposition. So I was interested, really, from that would be probably when I was about the age of 9 or 10, before I came to King James's. And then there was a chap called Edgar Lustgarten who used to produce programmes about famous crimes, often based on inquiries carried out by New Scotland Yard, and I used to be fascinated by those. And so towards the end of my years at King James's, I wasn't entirely sure what I wanted to study at university, but eventually I opted for law, and that was the right decision for me.
And what about Judge John Deed? I mean, he seems to have
Judge John Deed,
quite a life.
Yeah, Judge John Deed's goings on are something that persecute me as far as my friends are concerned, because they all think it's true. It bears little resemblance, in fact, to what actually goes on.
That's your version.
That's true.
So going back to your school days, you were very keen on sport. On the academic side, what were you mainly interested in?
I think my strengths were in French and history and geography. Those were the things that I studied at A level. Although in those days, of course, Harry Taylor's system was perhaps in line with current thinking, that you don't simply get to the age of 16 and study 3 subjects. We had to study 5 subjects to begin with, so I did some English and Latin in the sixth form as well. But I was always one for the arts subjects. I was never any good at maths, and so my progress with the sciences would have been limited in any event. So I was an arts man from the word go.
Did you get involved in school plays and that sort of thing?
I didn't. No, I remember one year being given the job of prompting in the school play, but that's about as far as it got. I was in the school choir for a very short time under Harry Gledhill, who you will remember, and there came a day when I had to miss a football match because of choir practice, and I determined that that would never happen again. And so the following week I told Harry Gledhill that my voice had broken. He thought that was pretty unusual for a 12-year-old, but it furthered my football career, and that was the end of the singing.
Now, you mentioned the trust, also known, I think, as the King James's School Foundation.
Yes.
And I know it's something you've been heavily involved with in recent years.
Mm.
Can you tell me, first of all, what exactly is the School Foundation, and why did it become of great interest some years ago?
Well, the trust fund now is an amalgamation of a number of trust funds. There was property and money endowed to the school in the 19th century, and in the late 19th century it seems that the fund, which was set up for the benefit of students at Almondbury Grammar School, as it was called, was merged with the Wormald Trust. Now, students of history in Almondbury will realise that Almondbury Conservative Club is in fact Wormald Hall, built in 1631. And I assume that money from the Wormald Family Trust went into the School Trust Fund, and they combined, as I say, in about the late 19th century. What is equally clear is that once the school moved into local authority ownership in 1922, the affairs of the trust were taken over by the local authority, which then, of course, was Huddersfield Borough Council. But it appears that very quickly the affairs of the trust were neglected by Huddersfield Council, and then from 1974 onwards by Kirklees Council. Really, the story starts in 1976 because in that year the school cricket field was not being used at weekends, as had been the case throughout the 50s and 60s, certainly when I was there. On Saturday afternoon in the summer, the first 11 or the second 11 was playing at home on that beautiful cricket field. But by the mid-70s, the school was not fielding teams on Saturday afternoons, and so the field was going to waste, really. So a number of old Ormond Burien society members, and I was one of them, approached the then head teacher, who was called Alan Conley, and we asked if we might use the field and enter a team in the local league, and he was very supportive. He readily agreed. He said that we should pay a purely nominal rent, but that we were required to look after the pavilion, as he put it. And it was an arrangement as loose as that.
Doesn't sound unreasonable, does it?
Not unreasonable at all. And no one knew, of course, at that time, that the field was in fact owned by the King James's Foundation Trust. In fact, no one at school knew of the existence of that trust fund at that time. Now, the club flourished, and it became successful in the local leagues. It became the main user of the pavilion, which in fact had been erected in 1958, partly as a result of subscriptions provided by the old Ormond Burians.
I seem to remember, in fact, it was the old Ormond Burians that finished the painting on the day, because funds were so tight.
Yes, and it was opened by the Countess of Dartmouth in 1958. But as I say, by 1976 and into the early 80s, the school use of the field really diminished. By the early 1990s, the club was told that it would have to pay significantly more for its use of the field, and its contribution to the fabric of the building was going to count for nothing. We had, over the years, for instance, completely replaced the roof. We'd done that from our funds. Which, as it turns out, was a saving to the trust fund, which really had the responsibility for doing that.
Who was saying that you'd have to pay more?
Well, sadly, it was a mixture of Kirklees Council and the then head teacher. The school at that time, I have to say, seemed to have little regard for maintaining the tradition of cricket at the school, and indeed indicated that it had no further use for the pavilion, which we all found to be a rather sad state of affairs. And that caused some friction between the Ormond Burien Society and the school. However, the members of the old Ormond Burien's cricket club and the members of the society were not prepared to simply surrender the field and the pavilion, which of course would have meant the demise of the cricket club as well. And they set about safeguarding what we view as a very fine facility for future generations. And so we started to make inquiries about the ownership of the field and just who was responsible for various things. And it was then that we discovered that the King James's Foundation Trust was the legal owner and not Kirklees Council, as had previously been assumed. Well, when we found out about that, the society became even more interested. The affairs of this trust fund seemed to be shrouded in mystery. But it soon became apparent that Huddersfield Council and Kirklees Council, following on from them, had been in control of this trust fund from 1922 onwards, when the school went into local authority control. And so contact with the Charity Commission was the first line of action. And I made the first phone call in 1994, only to be told that Kirklees Council had not filed any accounts for this trust fund for 7 years. And I well remember the sense of embarrassment at the Charity Commission, because of course they have procedures that apply to prevent exactly this sort of thing happening. So their own systems had failed, and as I say, they were embarrassed about it. But
what was the apparent connection at this stage between this trust fund and the cricket field?
Well, simply that the cricket field is owned by the trust fund. They are the legal owner. As we found out subsequently, the trust fund owns quite a lot of properties, much more valuable than the cricket field, the trust fund, for instance, owns Almondbury Conservative Club, Wormald Hall as it was. When we took over, we found that we owned about 10 of the properties, the cottages in Westgate.
And these were the result of bequests made in previous
over the years. And also as a result of the merger of the various trust funds. Now, if I can just perhaps locate here something of the letters that were passing between solicitors who were acting on our behalf and the local authority in the build-up to the removal of Kirklees Council from the trust fund, which actually took place in 2001. What we had, as I say, the Charity Commission were pretty embarrassed to find that they had allowed this trust fund not to file accounts for 7 years. They had in fact approved a new scheme in 1987, but the Charity Commission had clearly not looked into the recent financial history of the trust before they approved that new scheme. But Kirklees Council, having obtained a new scheme in 1987, then studiously avoided dealing with the trust in a proper manner. And ultimately, the local authority was given a number of deadlines to file these accounts, and it was amusing in some ways that they finished up faxing the accounts over to the Charity Commission in November of 1995 in such a way that it became clear that they were reconstructing the accounts going backwards. By 1998, the Charity Commission came to a meeting confirming that there were very clear breaches of trust by Kirklees Council, with examples of self-dealing and a failure to review rents. By self-dealing, what I mean is that Kirklees Council had been borrowing money from the trust fund for its own purposes at a rate of interest set by itself, with a repayment date to suit itself. Now, you've only to put it in those terms to realise how improper that conduct was. However, it took some time. The Charity Commission are not renowned for moving quickly, but ultimately they were persuaded that these breaches of trust were pretty serious, and we managed to unearth a number of documents that showed that the chairman of the governors in 1995 had complained that because they were failing to review rents, the trust fund and therefore the school was losing £12,500 a year. One of the neighbours in Arkenley Lane had agreed to purchase a piece of land from the trust fund. This was a piece of land that is in fact landlocked behind the houses in Arkenley Lane and between that house and the stream that runs down the bottom of the valley. But that agreement having been reached, Kirklees Council was not able to prove title because it had lost the title deeds. And then we discovered perhaps the most serious breach, whereby they had sold a property at an undervalue, because what had happened was that Kirklees had represented to a tenant of a house in Westgate that they were in fact tenants of the council. Those people understood themselves to be council tenants, and when they came to exercise their right to buy under the housing legislation, it then became apparent that Kirklees Council did not own it, but that the King James's Foundation did. And in other words, these people were not entitled to buy it. In order to avoid embarrassment and to buy off these people, they then sold the property to them, notwithstanding, at a very serious undervalue, and we're talking about perhaps £40,000 or £50,000 less than the house was worth. And that, of course, is money that at that stage was lost to the trust fund. So the more we dug into this, the more interested we became. I did a lot of the research work, looking at documents and obtaining documents, but I was helped enormously by Nigel Priestley, who's an Old Ormondburian and now the senior partner of a firm of solicitors in Huddersfield called Ridley and Hall. He did the letter writing with the Charity Commission and with Kirk Lees, and he attended a number of meetings with me as well. He put in a great deal of unpaid work in order to sort this matter out. Now, as the Ormondburians exposed more and more examples of maladministration, of course the society became rather unpopular with Kirklees Council. The cricket club contended that the arrangement from 1976 meant that it had an annual tenancy, that it couldn't just be thrown off the field. Notwithstanding that, the local authority locked the cricket club out of the field without any warning whatsoever. The gates were padlocked, the pavilion was padlocked, and this was done, from memory, at the beginning of March, just at the time when the groundsman was wanting to get on with his pre-season work. And the upshot of that was that Nigel Priestley took Kirklees Council to court. They got a very bloody nose in court because of the high-handed way in which they'd reacted. They were ordered to restore access to the cricket club immediately and to pay costs, and the judge was highly critical of them. Notwithstanding that, it seems they didn't learn, because they then continued to antagonise the Charity Commission by fighting a furious rearguard action once they'd been told that really they had to jump before they were pushed, and that their tenure was coming to an end. And that they fought the new proposals by opposing any member of the Old Ormondburian Society being on the new panel of trustees. Again, they were unsuccessful, and it was in September of 2001 that control of the trust passed to 8 individual trustees, 4 of whom were Old Ormondburians. I became the chairman of the trust at that time, and I still act in that capacity. Our first job was to investigate the obvious losses to the trust fund, and that was very difficult because even at that stage Kirklees Council was reluctant to release old records. But eventually we had enough information so that by the end of 2002 we could show that the losses were actually immense. I mentioned earlier that the trust fund owns Ormondbury Conservative Club, but there were also about 10 houses in Westgate. There was land and leasehold interests in Gulka. We're not quite sure how they came into an Ormondbury trust, but there they were. And also at that time the trust fund owned all the freehold interests of the houses in Wormald Street in the centre of the village, because they're all on long leases. We've since disposed of those ground rents because they're not really now worth collecting on an annual basis. But we found that the council had also treated a number of the houses in Westgate as council houses, and so the money had gone into the Kirklees rent roll rather than into the trust fund. And we were pretty sure that we could show that the default had gone back at least 50 years to 1951, and possibly all the way back to 1922 when the council, Huddersfield Council, first took over.
What was the position of the school while this was going on, Graham?
Well, the school was in a difficult position. Because as a local authority school, it was receiving its legal advice from the local authority solicitors.
Quite, yes.
And the local authority solicitors were, of course, the people who were adamant that there was nothing wrong, that no one else from the Olmobeurian Society should have anything to do with this, that really we were a thoroughly bad lot. So the position of the headmaster was somewhat difficult. But of course we had the independent legal advice of Nigel Priestley in particular, but the society as a whole is not short of lawyers, as you can imagine, and we knew that we had a good claim, and so we decided to plough on. We invited Kirklees Council to discuss the problem, and they refused. They were still insisting that there was no claim, and so we were left with no alternative but to sue. Proceedings under the Charities Act are quite rare. They're dealt with in the Chancery Division of the High Court, and they're dealt with by only a handful of specialist barristers in the country. We managed to identify one in Manchester who prepared our claim, and it was then issued in the Chancery Division of the High Court in Manchester. At that stage they agreed to talk, and what happened was that a mediation session was set up, what some of the lawyers call now alternative dispute resolution, where you get round a table with an experienced and informed chairman who listens to both sides and tries to bring the two sides together. Of course, if he's not successful, the High Court action simply proceeds. But by this time, I think it was dawning on them that we meant business. And so this mediation was set up. It took place at the George Hotel in Huddersfield. The Olmobeurian side was represented by our solicitor, a man called Robin Barraclough, who is now himself a district judge. And there were three trustees present, myself, Michael Buck and Michael Woodhead. The local authority was represented in force by their barrister, their solicitor, about six different officers from Kirklees Council, and also the leader of the council, who popped in at one stage to see how badly things were going. Also present at this mediation was the solicitor for the Attorney General. Now, when you start proceedings under the Charities Act, you have to involve, as a nominal defendant, the Attorney General of England and Wales. And that's because, in our constitution, the Attorney General is looked upon as the guardian of charitable trusts. And he has to be a party to any proceedings to ensure that the beneficiary, that is the school in this case, is never sold short. So the Attorney General actually sent his solicitor to the mediation. We thought to take a watching brief, see what the arguments were, so that the Attorney General would be better informed if and when the matter went to the High Court, which would have probably been some 12 months later. And I think it came as a very severe blow to the local authority when the Attorney General, or his solicitor, roundly criticised them for their incompetence. It became clear at that stage that if the matter did go to trial, the Attorney General would be very much on our side. Nevertheless, the mediation session took 15 hours. I well remember leaving at 12:30, when the settlement had finally been agreed. The local authority insisted on a confidentiality clause, and it was easy for us to understand why they wanted that. One amusing adjunct to that really was that one of the council officials was seen to be chuckling to himself as this confidentiality clause was being drafted, and when we asked him why, he said it was a complete waste of time because so many of the councillors in Kirklees have big mouths. Well, we all had a good laugh about that, but how right he was, because within days the exact settlement figure, which I'm not even allowed to reveal to you now under the terms of that agreement, was splashed right across the front page of the Examiner, in bold type, in red, and they got the exact figure, and we had settled for a very substantial figure indeed. We were content with the settlement. In that sort of mediation process, there always has to be give and take. One of the things we had to take into account was the fact that if we didn't settle it, we would be fighting the case through to the High Court for another 12, 18 months perhaps, and during that time all the income of the trust would be directed towards the legal proceedings and the school wouldn't benefit. Mm-hmm. But as a result of that settlement and the money that was paid, the trust now has a portfolio of properties and investments nearing £2 million. The trust meets about four or five times a year when we make grants to the school. It enables us to guarantee a minimum of £40,000 a year to the school from interest on investments. And I think the society can be very proud of the part that it's played in exposing the negligence of the council and bringing them to account. And the society did so when others more closely connected with the school at that time either would not or could not do it. So the benefit to the school in terms of annual income will of course continue now indefinitely into the future. And that's why I think that in this particular instance the society really has managed to pursue its first objective, which is to uphold the honour and status of the school.